Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Imagine a technology that lets humans stack the deck against natural selection. An altered gene of our choosing would replace a gene that occurs in a wild population. And that change would be passed down from generation to generation.
It's a promising new technology that could eradicate malaria and control invasive species. But is it playing God? Is it a Darwinian nightmare? Whatever it is, it's no longer in the realm of the imaginary.
A team of researchers, some from Harvard and MIT, recently released two papers outlining a feasible way to edit genes in wild populations. It's done using a method known as gene drive.
The elements to create gene drive technology already exist, but they haven't yet been combined and tested in the lab. Before that happens, the researchers want to have a public discussion about the risks and benefits of this kind of gene manipulation. And we would like to have that discussion here on Radio Boston. So joining me now in the studio are two of these researchers. Kevin Esfeld is a research fellow at the Weiss Institute at Harvard University and a lead author on the two papers. Kevin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Ken Oye is a professor of political science and engineering systems at MIT, and he directs MIT's program on emerging technologies. Kevin, Ken, welcome to you as well.
A great pleasure.
And listeners, we want you to share your thoughts. We want to know what you think of the idea of altering the DNA of whole populations in the wild. And if that were to happen, what kind of precautions you would like to see in place? Are there some things that you don't think should be scientifically tampered with? We want to know how you balance in your minds the greater good of this with the potential risks. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Kevin, let's start with you in terms of the concept for gene drive technology, because something similar to gene drive already occurs in nature. So would you first explain how it works in the natural world?
So it works in a number of different ways in the natural world, and they all come down to anthropomorphize a bit. Genes want to replicate, and I say want in quotes because, of course, genes don't want anything, but natural selection rewards genes that replicate. And normally this happens because the gene manages to improve the odds of the organism surviving and reproducing. That's what we think of when we say natural selection or evolution in the wild. But there's another way for genes to gain an edge, and that is to ensure that they are inherited. Now, most genes have a 50-50 chance of being passed on to offspring because we have, in most organisms, there's two different versions of the gene, and one of them will be passed on. So, but you can imagine that any gene that figures out a way to stack the deck in its favor to ensure that it, rather than its competitor, is passed on to offspring will have an advantage in the wild and will spread. And that's why these genes, which we call gene drives, are actually abundant in nature. They're everywhere. Almost every species has some form of gene drive.
And why drive, by the way? Is the idea that it's sort of driving itself through a species population?
That's right. We tend to envision it as the gene drive is the chauffeur, and at least for our purposes, we're envisioning using the drive to spread an alteration of our choice through a population.
So you want to take those 50-50 odds and improve them in a sense, improve them in the direction you would like to improve them.
Exactly.
So what would you do in the lab to make that happen?
So in the lab, when we edit genomes now, we use a technology called CRISPR, which is actually very new. It didn't exist 2 years ago, and we've been developing it over the last couple of years. And we know that it allows us to edit genomes of many different species throughout the kingdoms of life. CRISPR is a form of molecular scissors. So we use it.
That's a great analogy.
We use it to cut the gene that we want to edit, and we supply an altered version. And when the cell attempts to repair the cut, it uses our altered version as the template. Now, our suggestion that we outline is, instead of simply delivering the CRISPR system and the altered gene, what if we encode the CRISPR system next to the altered gene so that when the cell repairs the cut, it incorporates the altered gene and the CRISPR system. Then when that organism mates, its offspring will inherit the altered gene and the CRISPR system.
So you would have changed the DNA of the organism, and then that would spread in the wild through a whole population.
Because in the next generation, assuming our altered organism mates with a one in the wild, then the offspring will inherit one copy of the altered gene and the CRISPR system, and one copy of the wild version. But then just like in the original organism in the laboratory, CRISPR would then cut the wild version of the gene and the cell would copy over the altered version and CRISPR. And so this editing event would take place in every generation.
So let's talk about practical application. What kind of genes might you be targeting? What would you want to change to make what you consider an improvement to something out in the wild?
Well, I would say that the most obvious improvement that we could make would be to alter mosquitoes so that they cannot carry diseases such as malaria. Malaria is a terrible disease. It kills 650,000 people every year, most of them children under five, and sickens 200 million. If we could alter the five or so major vector species that are the mosquitoes that carry this so that they could not transmit it, we might actually have a shot at eradicating this terrible disease.
And other insect-borne illnesses, I assume. It could apply to any kind of insect, ticks, for example.
Lyme fever would be a very good application.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What about invasive species? How could this help in that area?
So our work really builds off of the theoretical underpinnings by a brilliant, brilliant scientist by the name of Austin Burt at Imperial College London. And he's a theorist and a modeler, and he's shown that if you target genes that are important for reproduction in an organism, then the drive can still spread, and when two drive-containing organisms mate, the offspring will they will not be able to have offspring. But when they mate with a wild organism, then as normal, all of the offspring will have the drive. So you can imagine when this happens, you release, we call this a suppression drive. When it's released into the wild, when it's very rare, most organisms with the drive are going to mate with wild-type organisms, and it will spread very rapidly. But eventually, they're going to start mating with each other, and those matings will produce no offspring, and it will cause a population crash.
So you could make, besides trying to eradicate insect-borne diseases, maybe making weeds more or less vulnerable to pesticides, maybe more vulnerable to pesticides.
So that's a slightly different application. If we can stay on invasive species for just a moment.
Uh-huh.
So one application of the suppression drive would be to control populations of, say, cane toads in Australia, or the sort of the classic example of the poisonous invader that's taking over the helpless ecosystem.
Right. They were brought in for, of course, always what is believed to be a beneficial purpose, and there's an unintended consequence.
And in fairness to my ecologist colleagues, they've gotten a lot better at doing that sort of thing. The cane toad introduction was in the 1930s, as were most of the ones where scientists definitely made some big mistakes. And honestly, a lot of the species were introduced either through intentional malice or simply because people weren't thinking about it. Rabbits in Australia is a great example of the latter. But they're all even some closer to home. Mosquitoes, for example, are not native to Hawaii. If you had gone to Hawaii 200 years ago, you would never have gotten bitten. And while it's an annoyance to us, those mosquitoes also carry bird pox and bird malaria. And those diseases are together wiping out the native birds of Hawaii. And right now, the birds are hanging on at high elevations where the mosquitoes can't live. But as the climate warms, then the mosquitoes are rising every year, and the birds have less and less habitat left. So we might be able to use these suppression drives to remove the invasive mosquitoes that are killing the native birds.
Kevin, I'm imagining that some listeners, as they hear about the general idea of editing genes or gene manipulation, immediately think about GMO, genetically modified organisms, which obviously enormous ongoing debate about that, legislation in the works that might require labeling. How is this different than genetically modified organisms?
Well, in terms of technically speaking, what we're talking about here is a way of intentionally spreading a modification through a wild population. In the case of GMOs, people generally refer to our food crops and so forth. Now, food crops are actually a terrible, terrible application of this gene drive technology. It just wouldn't work very well. And we don't really see any potential applications of it in certainly not in the United States.
And if I could jump in, is part of the issue here is that it only applies to things that sexually reproduce, like animals, plants, insects, animals and insects, so there doesn't apply to every type of species, not with ones with asexual reproduction.
That's exactly right. We cannot, for example, gene drive bacteria or viruses or anything that reproduces primarily or exclusively asexually.
Which for some people may be an unfortunate, since we may want to try to manipulate the genes of bacteria or viruses, but that wouldn't apply to this.
That would be great. I mean, there are some diseases that actually are sexually reproducing. Schistosomiasis, liver flukes in Africa is one example. But they're pretty rare compared to the viruses we want to get rid of. However, a lot of viruses have animal reservoirs, and we can't get rid of them in wild populations because we just can't go out and vaccinate every wild organism. With a gene drive, we might be able to genetically immunize those wild populations against diseases. It's very far out there. And mind you, once again, just to remind all the listeners, we haven't actually done this in laboratory yet. The reason why we went public with this is this is obviously a very serious and powerful technology, and we need to involve the public in determining how and whether we use it.
We're talking here on Radio Boston about a new technology created by some researchers out of Harvard and MIT, among other institutions, that would allow them to alter the DNA of whole populations in the wild. And we've been talking about some of the benefits of that, potentially eliminating insect-borne diseases and so forth. Kevin Esfeldt, let me bring in your colleague here, Ken Oyeh. Ken, we've been talking about the good, possibly beneficial applications. There are clearly risks. Outline for us some of the concerns you have, which are why you want to have this public debate about whether this is a good idea. Where could this go wrong?
Okay, so a little bit of background here. Kevin and I met because our group at MIT and the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington were asked by NSF to do a series of workshops on the ecological effects of synthetic biology, a little broader topic than the gene drives. And Kevin stepped forward and put gene drives into play as an example for discussion in one of the workshops. So we're sitting there, and we put together a group that was a little unusual. It included everyone from environmental NGOs to ecological scientists to an evolutionary ecologist who was also the head of the biological division of NSF. And the example that really, I think, triggered the most intense and interesting discussion by far, and I think Kevin would agree with this, was his example. You take ordinary applications of synthetic biology and genetic engineering, and they don't have this property of propagating through wild populations by design. And that is the power of this technology in terms of applications like engineering mosquitoes. But as Kevin pointed out, the introduction of species sometimes has unexpected results, and we want to be careful.
Right. So tell us, what would be a worst-case scenario?
Well, okay, worst-case scenarios are a little bit hard to define. We can talk about some limits and risks. So right off the top, we know that this is not likely to have very significant effects on long-lived, slow-reproducing species.
Like humans.
Humans, elephants, blue whales. Let's move them off the table. On the other hand, you take species that reproduce with short cycle times, or in situations where you might have a female carrying huge numbers of eggs, and it could
insects,
be moving through
insects,
fish, potentially, and others. And it could move through quickly. And that's actually at the heart of the beneficial applications Kevin's talking about. But we also really need to understand potential side effects of the following sort. If you take traditional genetic engineering, what you have is an assumption that you don't have to worry about mutation. After all, if you take those seed guys, they're producing seed and putting them out every year. If you turn to this stuff, there's the possibility that the drives that Kevin is designing could mutate and change, and we're not sure of what effects they have. And instead of saying, don't worry, we're not sure, we're saying, let's find out, and hence the need for a research program directly addressing what the risks might be.
Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on this, let us know what you think about the idea of altering the DNA of species in a way that could change a whole population in the wild. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What would you like to see this applied to? Where do you think it might go wrong? What are your concerns? We have a caller from Cambridge, and this is Michael. Michael, your thoughts about all this?
Yes, actually, I just wanted to both congratulate you and tell you you're scaring the hell out of me. natural progression of the kind of work that's being done in genetics, but I think that I actually teach medical students, and one of the things that I always tell them is under the right conditions of pressure, temperature, and humidity, the organism will do whatever the hell it damn well wants to. I think that putting genes deliberately into animal species for the purpose of passing that on to, you know, downstream generations is theoretically a good idea. But it isn't that much removed from introducing, I don't know, rabbits into Australia so that you'll have a reliable food source. Theoretically, it sounds good, but when you try to multiply that by all the potential ecological changes that could occur that you have not anticipated, simply put, I'd like to eliminate all mosquitoes. I hate being bitten by mosquitoes. But what happens when you then destroy one of the major food sources of avian populations? Are you ready for the ramifications of losing species of birds because of that? I think that just because we have the ability to do a thing doesn't mean we necessarily should.
And I think, Michael, this is the exact kind of concern that is at the center of this debate. So let's turn to Kevin. Let's turn to Ken. Ken, you look like you want to weigh in on this. How would you address Michael's concern?
So Michael's absolutely correct. that we need to be attentive to and cautious. Hence, again, the call for the research to be analyzing and evaluating the side effects, but also recognizing that you might be wrong. A couple quick observations. The caller noted that eliminating a species can be quite dangerous, and we agree with that. The application, let's call it the killer application, although I don't necessarily want to use that terminology, but the killer application here might be eliminating the ability of mosquitoes to carry malaria.
So they would still exist to be food
not,
for birds and bats.
But
they
not
just
eliminating
couldn't be disease carriers.
And so in the article that we wrote in Science, we went through a series of precautionary measures that we believe should be taken before this technology is introduced in the wild to be evaluating systematically effects and side effects going in. We want to be avoiding exactly the kind of problem that the caller pointed to, where you do something and then say, oops, maybe we should have thought of that before.
And Kevin Esfeld, I want to notice that in a way you've also built in what might be protective measures, which is a reverse gene drive, meaning that if there was a change or there were a change that you felt uncomfortable with, you could then go back and change it back.
That's actually one of the great advantages of the technology. And one of the other reasons why I wanted to bring this up in advance, because when we bring up a technology not only to the public but also the scientific community before developing it fully, then we have a chance to incorporate safeguards into the development. And in the case of gene drives, one great advantage is that we should be able to build reversal drives. And we recommend that whenever a group is proposing to build a drive that is intended to alter a wild species, they should at the same time build and test a reversal drive that will undo that exact modification.
So how confident do you feel that if this technology were ever put into place and you were doing it and something went wrong, you could go out there and correct a mistake that is now spreading through populations? But if you've unleashed something, do you feel confident that you can leash it again?
I feel confident that we can undo the genome level change. That is not the same thing as undoing the ecological effects,
because
which are every bit as complicated as Michael just said.
And for example, if you had changed the population, that population is still going to exist out there until it dies off or is killed off. So,
well, until the reversal drive changes it back to the way it was before. However, any ripple effects in the ecosystem that have already occurred will not necessarily be undone just because the original source is gone.
We also have a caller from West Newberry. This is Jill. And Jill, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I just had two words, Jurassic Park. I believe Michael Crichton, and I will paraphrase, something to the effect of nature will have its way, and that the idea that humans have control, that we think we have control over nature, is ridiculous. And it's one thing to explore things in a lab, but nobody has any idea of what's going to happen when it gets out.
Jill, thank you for that. Kevin and Ken, we are clearly hearing some concern on the part of listeners. Can you deal in part with the regulatory side of this? What regulations and other precautions would need to be in place for the public, do you think, to feel comfortable or more comfortable?
In the Science article, we went over potential gaps in regulation, and they're pretty substantial. If you take the idea of suppressing invasive species, the idea of releasing Asian carp with gene drives, in order to drive down their incidence in the Great Lakes or areas approaching the Great Lakes, you know how that would be regulated now? As veterinary medicine by the FDA. And so you'd be sitting there trying to produce evidence of safety and efficacy from the perspective of the carp. And it doesn't make sense. There's just a mismatch between this technology and the regulatory structure. Or if you move to the area of security, the tip of the spear for U.S. and international security policy are lists of bacteria and viruses that carry terrible things. This is not going to be used on bacteria and virus, but there are potential security implications that we kind of raise in the article. The possibility of not necessarily attacking crops in the United States, but it could be used in developing countries where they don't do the seed commercially. And again, a mismatch. And so one of the things that we're calling for is not just more research on the risks and on the science, but also to be drawing attention to holes or gaps or mismatches in regulation so that those issues can be addressed before gene drives are introduced.
Listeners, we're hearing concern, if you heard our calls, people who talk about this being frightening, they think about Jurassic Park. If you're excited, let us know as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're again talking about the prospect, this technology that potentially exists to alter the DNA of whole populations in ways that could get rid of insect-borne diseases and that sort of thing. We have a caller from Millbury. This is Kelly. And Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi. I believe I'm also on the side of concern, and I'm going to state it in the most compassionate way possible. But to use the first speaker's example about, you know, nearly eradicating malaria, and then to further hear that the possibility of changing the genes of plants or not being able to change the genes of plants is scary to me, because if we were to say, if we were to allow for that 650,000 people who would normally pass from malaria to exist, then I would be weary of a shortage of food. Basically, you know, if the GMOs that are going into the food aren't comparable to the size of population growth because we're eradicating other diseases, that's just part of my concern.
Interesting. So it sounds like you're saying maybe malaria plays a role at keeping the human population in check. Would you like to weigh in on that, Ken Oya?
Oh, absolutely. We do have a population problem, and you'd have to be an absolute idiot to not see it, and Kelly's right to be raising that. But the way that you tackle the population problem is not by killing off infants in developing countries with diseases like malaria. I have a daughter who's actually working as a development economist in Myanmar. It's an area where malaria is pretty endemic. We have friends that are working in Africa. This is not the way that you handle overpopulation. We accept the point that she's making on the human burdens, but at the same time, let's talk about other ways of addressing that problem.
We have another caller. This is Jean calling from Acton. And Jean, your thoughts about the idea of manipulating genes and manipulating DNA that could change traits of whole populations of species. I'm sorry, it's Greg from Acton. Greg, are you with us?
Oh, yeah, yes. I'm sorry about
my,
that.
My mistake.
Yes. So my concern is what would be the political discourse in the future for, say, an organization like the World Health Organization or the United Nations to prevent against any malicious use in the future? For instance, someone trying to hijack this for a form of terrorism, like linking the gene drive with, say, smallpox even, or maybe using it for eugenic purposes, like a repeat of the Holocaust, for instance.
Greg, thank you for that. And Kevin and Ken, the theme of concern continues. But that's obviously a very serious issue. What would you say to that?
Okay, first, we're not talking bacteria or viruses, but lay that off to the side. There are security implications, and there has to be a global discussion on the security implications of gene drives. In about 2 weeks, I've been invited to speak at the UN Biological Weapons Convention meeting of experts in Geneva on exactly this issue. You're going to be talking about hundreds of people from all over the world talking about the very question that the caller raised. At the same time, how to do it is a big problem. We don't have strong international conventions for handling, for example, environmental issues and effects. On security, there are things in place, but they're incomplete. And again, this funny little example, and it's perspective, and I want to underline perspective, exposes gaps and weaknesses in international conventions and regulatory structures.
I'd also like to directly address Greg's concern in that issue. On the technical side, this cannot be used to alter human diseases because the vast majority of those are not sexually reproducing. And then again, this can only do sexually reproducing organisms. Also, to tie it into previous callers' concerns about the controllability of nature, once this goes, and again, this echoes what Ken brought up earlier, the gene drive will continue to drive the altered trait, but there is nothing that prevents the altered trait from mutating so that it is less costly to the organism. And remember, that's the reason why we can't alter wild populations now. It's because our traits tend to be costly to the organism. So if one were to try to spread a human disease through a gene drive in some other species so as to spread it, then that would be a very costly trait, and it would be immediately removed from the population. Also, in terms of addressing the eugenics issue, it would take
many centuries, if not millennia, for a gene drive to alter any significant fraction of the human population.
Because of how long it takes for humans to
just because
reproduce.
It takes us so long to reproduce. So Thankfully, that is just something that's not on the table.
Kevin and Ken, we have more callers I wish we could get to. There's clearly a lot of interest in this issue and a lot of concern. Thanks to both of you for coming in. If this does ever actually end up happening, we hope we can bring you back in again so you can tell us about how it's been working. Kevin Esfeld is a research fellow at the Weiss Institute at Harvard, and Ken Oye is a professor of political science and engineering systems at MIT. Both of them are involved in working on gene drive technology, and thanks to both of you for coming in today. Stay with us. Coming up, fishermen in the U.S. harvest millions of tons of fish every year. So why does the vast majority of the seafood we eat come from overseas? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.